It's so funny. For such an energetic person, the space around him was always so cold. And anyway, his grand plans for himself always exceeded his actual talent. She shrugged with a look of resignation. I felt a wave of hot emotion in my chest. "Jim didn't steal the lyrics from me," I said. "I gave them to him. They were just sitting in a drawer in the dark, no use to anyone. I had to help him." Martha surveyed me so intently I felt lightheaded. "Everything I've done in this Neverworld," she said, "the good, the weird, the absurd, the exhausting, was for you. Pushing the discussion in a calculated direction, asking you the pointed questions so I'd appear impartial, distracting the others from seeing the rot that kept bubbling up around you all the time. Mold, breaking glass, tar, oil, tumbling trees, falling lookout towers. God, B, it was like trying to hide a typhoon swirling around you, all because of this secret you were hiding. That you were there that night." She shook her head, biting her lip. "I even spent 1,000,000 hours talking to this kooky professor with scary facial hair and bad breath at Brown to learn the art of persuasion, to implant the idea in all of their heads that you had to go on, because you had to be the one to tell our story." My mind was crawling stupidly over her words like a crab, trying to make them out. What was she talking about? I had voted for Martha. Martha was going to live. "I couldn't tell you what I was doing because you'd have tried to stop me. You'd have messed it all up. We had to get to the bottom of Jim's death for the vote, but you had to stay beyond blame. You had to remain Sister B." She shook her head. "I'm only telling you all this so you'll know. So you'll see. Because we all have our words tucked away in notebooks and drawers in the dark. You can't just give them away, B. They're yours. Like a fingerprint. Like your children. They are the light that shines your way. Without them, you'll be lost." She reached out and gently tucked loose strands of hair behind my ears. "Never, ever give away your words again." Martha, I was so wrong. Anyway, she removed her glasses, folding them, carefully setting them on the seat beside her with a faint smile. Chapter 72. This is only the beginning. She stood and, mumbling something that sounded like breadcrumbs, she dove into the water, kicking into the turquoise depths. I sat there, shaken, unable to move. So absolutely wrong. I lurched to my feet, shading my eyes. "Martha!" There was no sign of her. Whitley and Kipling, swimming a few yards away, turned in alarm. "She was just here. Martha, I have to tell her. I have to let her know." I was untying the skiff, grabbing the oars, crying as I steered the boat between the trees. "Martha!" I jumped overboard, swam into the darkness, reached out into the empty cold. When Whitley and Kip hauled me back into the boat, I was sobbing. "She was just here, and now it's too late. Too late. Don't you realize? Martha, she's never coming back. I have to tell her. She's gone, and it's too late now to tell her."
"Shh,"
said Whitley, hugging me and wiping the tears from my cheeks. "It's all over now, Bee. Look around. It's almost gone. Look around. It's almost gone." If only someone had told me that before. About life. If only I had understood. We didn't speak after that. We didn't need to. All we did was wrap ourselves in the blanket and gaze out at the water. Cannon was already somewhere else. The sun was setting. It had turned the bold orange of children's paintings, and it was casting a warmth on our faces so gentle it seeped into us, filling every dark hole and lighting every corner. I'd felt this way before, back at Darrow on some ordinary Tuesday with my friends, when one of them said what I felt and life sharpened into focus as it did sometimes. There was a momentary stillness, a sense of the eternal in the strands of our laughter like wind-blown ponytails, in the touch of our shoulders side by side. Something began to happen to me. Whether it was death or some other state in the mystery of all life, I didn't know. It pulled me to the bottom of the boat, leaving me staring up at the vast yellow sky. They had more time in their last wake, Kipling and Witt. But they would feel it eventually. I could see them crouched beside me, whispering words I couldn't hear, uncertain yet unafraid, their hands warm as they squeezed mine, waiting for what came next. I would never let go of them. Never. Then their faces dissolved into the darkening day, and I slipped away. Chapter 26. I was floating in milky space. Something hard was shoved down my throat. I heard footsteps.
"Good morning," a man was speaking. "How are you holding up?"
There was a clattering noise. Someone was beside me.
"I know this is difficult. As I explained yesterday, we'll be taking this one step at a time. Her weaning parameters look very good. So I'm hoping to remove her breathing tube today. We need to see if she can follow commands."
There was a flurry of activity, hushed whispering. A hand touched my arm.
"Beatrice, can you open your eyes for me?"
I blinked. All I could see were streaks of color. "Oh my God."
"Beatrice?"
There she goes.
"Bumblebee?"
"Can you show me two fingers?"
Dizziness. I was floating in a swamp. I tried to lift my hand. My throat was on fire.
"What about your other hand?" "That's great. Wiggle your toes."
Someone was leaning over me. Suddenly, a light beamed into my eyes, sending a hot purple pinball knocking around my skull. I blinked again. That was when I saw a TV on the wall. It was a morning talk show, the sound muted, the date at the bottom of the screen snapping into focus. 7:21 a.m., September 10. I was alive. As I fell back into the warm, watery darkness, my final conversation with Martha drifted through my head. It felt like she'd just left me moments ago. Her confession had turned me inside out. It was the secret I'd kept so deep inside my heart it had actually remained buried, out of sight, like a missing airplane that had vanished with such totality some questioned whether the passengers had even existed. Whitley hadn't realized how right she was. When you think about it, we all killed Jim. No one had ever questioned me. Not my friends, not the police, not my parents. No one. Because I was the good one. Sister B. "I'm going to the quarry. Meet me." In my dorm room, I listened to Jim's message over and over again, staring out the window at the empty lawn. I was so alone. I loved him, yet I hated him. I hated how he could make me feel so alive, then invisible, as if he were a magician and I was the rabbit in his hat. I was desperate to see him, forgive him, to banish him from my thoughts. I wished he'd never seen anything rare in me. The prospect of being without him was too painful to imagine. I jumped out of bed, threw off my pajamas, and slipped on the sexy lingerie I'd saved up for, the tight white jean shorts Jim liked, the white off-the-shoulder Gucci top borrowed from Whitley. I was going to sleep with him. It was a stupid decision, but it filled me with excitement, a concrete resolution I could hold on to like a tow rope. I put on eyeliner and mascara, Whitley's red MAC lipstick. I pulled my hair out of its usual ponytail so it fell down my back. I pulled on my Converse, threw two candles into my backpack, yanked the comforter off my bed.
Then I went running out to Vulcan Quarry. By a stroke of luck, I was so distracted by my decision to sleep with Jim that I left my phone on the sink in the bathroom. Later, I would gather that the detectives, pinging the cell towers on the night Jim died, saw that mine hadn't moved, providing me with an alibi. Yet if they had questioned me, I doubted they would have suspected I was lying. No one ever doubted anything I said. And they should have. When I arrived at the quarry, it was 12:15. There was no sign of Jim. He hadn't arrived yet. The night was cool, the sky clear, stars bright. We always met at the base of the foreman's lookout and did the ascent on the ladder together. This time, I went first. I wanted to set everything up to surprise him. I couldn't wait to see him, to forget it all, to go back to how things were in the beginning. I was scared, too. Scared to be with him again. Scared of the doubt in my head. As I climbed, I noticed that some of the nails holding the ladder's wooden rungs were looser than usual. Others were actually missing, especially in the final few feet where you reached the hatch. Halfway up the ladder, I stopped, noticing not just that my hands were shaking, but that I had ripped my entire left shin without realizing it. It was bleeding, gruesome-looking. I looked like a skinned possum. I started climbing down again. I didn't want Jim to see me like this. I was lopsided, overtired. I was ugly, unlike Vita Joshua. Vita Joshua was a siren. I should go back to my dorm. That was the right thing, the safe thing. I was almost on the ground when I stopped again. I was being a coward, meek, living so pianissimo, as Jim used to tell me. Why was I always so afraid of things happening to me? I began to climb up again. Carpe noctem, Whitley was always shrieking with her head back. Seize the night. Why couldn't I do it for once? When I reached the landing, I noticed that some of the nails holding the ladder's wood rungs were rattling. I lit the candles in the grimy room. I turned on the oil lamp on the old wood table where 100 Darrow students had carved their initials. I spread out my comforter, undressed, and waited. Soon I heard Jim. He was talking to himself, his words slurred. I rolled to my feet, gathering the comforter around me. I crept to the landing, peering out. He was halfway up the ladder. He was also drunk, swinging an arm out as he sang something. It was the lyrics to a new song in his musical, lyrics I had written. In the dark there grows a tree, a castle tower shelters thee. When will I stop? When will I see? There is no poison but for me. Muttering, he began to climb again. I tiptoed back inside and reclined across the comforter. He'd be here within seconds. It was happening. The thought gave me a strange feeling of emptiness. I was making a mistake. It was obvious. I needed to stay away from Jim. I should be asleep in my room. At that moment, I heard a clanging noise. Jim was screaming. I leapt to my feet. Three of the rungs by the landing had fallen away. Jim was barely holding on. He was straining to grab the next rung, but it was just out of reach. Gasping, he managed to swing his leg out so his foot rested on one of the crisscrossing beams supporting the tower legs.
B?
He blinked up at me, sweat glinting on his forehead.
Oh, God, B, thank God!
He held out his hand.
Pull me up!
I froze. He began to shout, his face contorting.
Beatrice! What's the matter with you? Pull me up! Beatrice!
What happened in those 4 seconds? I'll never know. It was so fast. I saw Jim, yet I couldn't move. I couldn't breathe. I wished with all my heart I could say it was just panic, but it wasn't. It was something else, too. A little cave inside my heart. Somehow I knew if I pulled him up, I'd never be free of him. Maybe Martha was right. Maybe it was about the lyrics he'd taken from me, albums I'd slid in front of him after he'd been sobbing that he was a hack, that he'd never be as accomplished as his father, that it was all over, his dreams were done. I'd gone into my closet and handed him my collection of dream soundtracks, 11 books of lyrics and drawings I'd worked on all my life for no reason except they were the one place I could be myself. Maybe it was how he had taken them, sniffing as if I'd only handed him a pen when he knew what they were to me, what they had meant, and started copying my rhymes into his notebook. Maybe it was the question that if he could so easily take my words, would he take everything else? My hesitation lasted only a moment. I sprang to life, racing toward him, wedging my feet in the landing door so they were secure, lying on my stomach, reaching to him. I was too late. He fell. His head smashed a wooden beam, his hat flying off. He hit the ground with a dull thud. He lay still, 5 stories below me, a streak of blood across his cheek. The next minute was a dream. The realization of what had just happened got bulldozed dumbly around my disintegrating mind. Jim's dead. Jim's dead. This isn't happening. Madly, I ran around the foreman's lookout, shivering, crying, blowing out candles, stuffing the comforter into my bag. I yanked on my clothes. I scrambled down the ladder 4 rungs at a time, barely making it around the gaping hole, threw myself into the grass. I rolled to my feet, staring down at Jim. Blood was oozing across the side of his face. His eyes were closed. He was dead. I was certain. I had to call the police. Yet, groping around in my backpack for my phone, I couldn't find it. Had I left it in the lookout? Looking up, I realized I'd accidentally left the oil lamp burning. It was then that I saw headlights igniting the grass like wildfire. A car. It appeared, bouncing along the rutted road, a loose hubcap, radio blaring. It was Mr. Joshua's beat-up red Nissan, the for sale sign taped to the back window. Vita Joshua. That was who I thought it was. What was she doing here? Had Jim meant to text her to meet him here, not me? The question sent me retreating into the dark, sprinting back through the grass. I needed to go home. I needed my mom. I found the opening in the fence and struggled through. Vita was going to find Jim and call an ambulance. He would be fine. Everything was fine. I don't remember sprinting back through the woods and across campus. The next thing I knew, I was barreling up the steps to the 4th floor of my dorm, racing down the hall. That must have been when Martha saw me. She lived on my floor, studied in the corner common room. I hurried to my room and locked the door, stripping naked. Everyone says I'm the good one, the kind one, so that means I am, doesn't it? It means I always do the right thing. I folded the La Perla underwear back into the tissue paper at the back of my drawer, returned Whitley's top to my closet. I found my phone where I'd left it on the bathroom sink. It was 1:02 a.m. No messages. My hands trembling, I managed to wipe the lipstick off, splash my face with cold water, yank the grass and leaves out of my hair. The realization of what I was doing hit me like a slap in the face. What was I doing, not calling the police? I had to go to Jim, my love. I began to dial 911, but the conversation I was about to have with the dispatcher made me stop. My boyfriend is lying dead in Vulcan Quarry. He fell. Please send an ambulance. Are you there? Where are you? I ran away. I was jealous of another girl. I was angry. I loved him. We'd had a fight. Cannon. I needed Cannon, the problem solver. I ran across the courtyard and climbed the oak tree to his room on the 3rd floor of Marlborough. I knocked on his window. No answer. I pulled it open. There was no one there. Kipling. Kipling would help me. He had a tower room in Eldred. I climbed back down the tree, raced across campus, slipped in through the fire exit up the back stairs. His room was empty, too. When I ran along the gable to Whitley's dorm room and knocked on her window, she too was missing. What was going on? Where was everyone? Martha. Racing back to Creston, I could see her light on in the window on the fourth floor, but imagining her flat response as I confessed to her, weeping, frightened, sent me running straight back to my room, my heart scuttling around like a rodent in my chest. I crawled into bed, staring at the ceiling. I kept telling myself to call my mom, but I couldn't move. Questions exploded in my head like grenades. If I'd never decided to surprise Jim, would he still be alive? Had he wanted to see Vita, not me? Had I loosened the rungs from climbing up and down and then up again? Where were my friends? Had Jim managed to call them for help, and were they with him right now, hearing all about what I'd done, that I let him fall and left him there? Had I killed Jim? I had to go back to the quarry. From there, I'd call the police. I climbed out of bed, yanked on jeans, a t-shirt, boots. I ran all the way out there again, petrified, certain Moses was going to catch me. When I arrived, it was after 4. My entire body shaking, I stepped to the spot under the foreman's lookout where the ladder was and stopped. Jim was gone. There was no sign he'd ever been there. No blood. A few blades of bent grass. Otherwise, there was nothing. Vita had found him and taken him to the hospital. Or, by some miracle, he'd gotten up and walked away unscathed, which meant he loathed me now. They all did. I returned to my room, staggered. All I wanted to do was die. I wandered through the next day like a zombie. When I thought of the night before, the memories were distorted, as if I'd made them up. Had it actually happened? There was no sign of Jim. No one had seen him. Whitley, Kip, and Cannon all acted friendly but stiff. They said they'd been in their rooms all night. Martha claimed she'd slept in the library. A day later, the news arrived. Jim had been found dead in the quarry lake. It was impossible. I didn't understand. What had happened after I'd run away? What had Vita done to Jim? Why were my friends all lying? What were they afraid of? To find answers, I'd gone to Wincroft. And all along, Martha had known my secret. Martha had been cleaning up my every move, all the while protecting me. How had I never seen it? How could I have been so blind? When I opened my eyes, I was propped up in a hospital bed. The room was in sharp focus. Pale yellow walls, counters and tabletops, an air conditioner, a vase of flowers, a teddy bear with a helium balloon proclaiming, "Get well soon." In front of me sat a plate of hospital food, a pink cup with a straw. There was no longer something lodged in my throat, though it felt scratchy and raw.
"She's awake," blurted my mom, turning from the window.
"My dear sweet Bumble," said my dad, stepping toward me. They hurried over, peering anxiously at me. My mom was gripping a wad of Kleenex, her hair standing vertical in places from sleeping in a chair. My dad had more gray hair than I remembered.
"Don't try to talk," he said. "All is well. You're at Miriam Hospital in Providence. You were in a car accident, and you sustained a head injury, bleeding on the surface of the brain. The doctors took care of it, and you're going to make a full recovery, okay, kiddo?"
I could tell my dad had instructed my mom not to talk very much, because she was nodding at everything he was saying, trying not to cry.
"Just tell me my friends are still alive. They're recovering in rooms down the hall."
"You're going to rest," said my mom, squeezing my hand. I looked past her across the room, where there was a framed print of a beach scene on the wall, and a dry erase board sign reading, "Your nurse on duty is Lori." A bony teenager with a mop of blonde hair was sitting in a chair by the door, staring at me.
It took me a moment to realize it was Sleepy Sam, the British teenage boy I'd scooped ice cream alongside all summer at the Crow. My mom followed my gaze.
You remember Sam?
He's come here every day to read to you, said my dad.
Sam shuffled over.
Really glad to see you open your eyes, Bee. Welcome back.
My dad clapped a hand on his shoulder.
Sam's a world-class dramatic reader. Who knew? He does all the different voices. 50 characters? No sweat. He could have a big future on the West End.
It was then that I noticed the book under Sam's arm. The cover was silver, with a collage of bird cages and steam trains, rosy-cheeked characters wearing top hats. The legendary cult saga of future pasts, present mysteries. The title sent a shock of adrenaline through me. The Dark House of Elsewhere Bend.
Good morning, Beatrice.
A silver-haired doctor in a white coat and green scrubs entered, carrying a clipboard and a paper coffee cup. He was accompanied by an Asian woman, also wearing a white coat.
Welcome back, he said. Allow me to introduce myself. I'm one of your physicians, Dr. Miller. It is a pleasure to finally meet you.
He was leaning over me, shining a light into my eyes. When I looked past it to his face, I gasped. I'd recognize him anywhere. He was and would forever be etched into my brain, floating in front of me whenever I closed my eyes for the rest of my life. Those green, all-seeing eyes, the mahogany baritone, the elegant, exhausted manner suggestive of a retired ballet dancer whose every step held thousands of hours of rehearsal and a faint ache. It couldn't be. It's impossible.
When can she move to the rehab facility? Asked my mom.
A few days. The weakness on the left side of her body and some of the short-term memory difficulties should improve over time, but it can take months.
The Keeper. He asked me to raise my arms, hold up three fingers, and bend my knees. He asked me if I knew what year it was, who the President of the United States was, my age. I was dizzy. I could hardly focus on anything he said, gaping as I was so incredulously at his face. He'd set down his paper cup on the tray in front of me. The tag on the tea bag dangled over the side. He grabbed the cup, took a sip, turned on his heel. He whispered something to my parents as they moved after him to the door. Then he slipped out with the woman in tow, vanishing down the hall. Chapter 27. My mom and dad had no choice but to tell me, even though I knew. Kipling, St. John. Whitley, Lansing. Canon, Beecham. Martha Ziegler. They were dead. I moved to the rehab facility and spent 6 weeks there, wandering the linoleum hallways with my soft grip adjustable cane, practicing going up and down stairs and raising my left arm, which trembled and shuddered with a mind of its own. I snuck onto the public computer after dinner the first night I was there and read about it. The accident was reported in the Providence Journal, the Warwick Beacon, and USA Today. All the articles used the same phrase, "shocking loss of young life." It also came up in a Republican Nation editorial about drunk driving and its prevalence in New England communities with a rising unemployment rate. Every story led with photos of Whitley, the textbook dead blonde dream girl, then moved on to Cannon, Kipling, and Martha, always mentioning Martha's full scholarship to MIT. My name was mentioned at the very end, the name of the lone survivor, the lucky one. Their Facebooks became memorials. I wasn't surprised. It had happened with Jim. Kids they barely knew at Darrow and friends from their hometowns posted messages like, "My heart's broken," and "The world is empty now." Littered with prayer emojis, anonymous comments of "life is pain," and gifs of Heath Ledger. I'd missed their funerals. I'd been in the hospital.
so I read about them. All their hometown newspapers did follow-ups to the tragedy, because the initial articles had racked up hundreds of shares and likes, featuring photos of some red-eyed family member reading a poem in a church pulpit. The blown-up, framed picture of Kipling/Cannon/Martha/Whitley stared out from the easel beside them, their unwitting happiness and total lack of understanding of what was to come a powerful reminder that life, among many things, was all hairpin curves. Linda Toledo speaks during a service for her daughter, Whitley Lansing, who died in a car accident. There was even an ongoing memorial of flowers, photos, candles, and teddy bears being left on the side of the coastal road at the crash site. People took pictures of it and posted them with hashtags like #RIP and #NeverForget. They never suffered, the police told my mom and dad. They all died on impact. I survived because I hadn't been wearing my seatbelt. I'd gotten tossed out, landing in a cluster of bushes, while the others were trapped in the car as it barreled down the ravine. Little did anyone know the real reason that I'd survived. I had lived a century inside a second. I had died thousands of times, learned about and loved four people in a way few ever had the chance. I had called a place home where details such as life and death didn't matter, where what did matter were the trembling moments of connection in between. And afterward, you felt nothing but awe for every second of your little life. So began life outside the Neverworld. It was different from what I remembered. I was different. And it wasn't just the scar of a reverse question mark wrapping around my skull above my right ear. My hair hid the scar, but it was there if you looked for it. My tattoo. My memento. To outsiders, I seemed confident, if a little solemn. I was less prone to biting my lip and tucking my hair behind my ears. I no longer worried whether people liked me, or whether I was pretty, or had made a mistake. I wasn't afraid to eat in a crowded cafeteria at a table alone, or talk to a cute boy I didn't know, or to sing karaoke, audition, give a speech. All the things people spend so much time worrying about in this world, the Neverworld had unchained me from all that. I was no longer in a hurry to fill silence. I could just let it sit forever, like a bowl of fruit. My parents' friends whispered, "Beatrice has really come out of her shell," and, "You must be so relieved." They marveled when they heard the news that I had transferred to Boston College, was majoring in music theory and art history, working part-time at a video game company, volunteering at a nonprofit that had people read books at bedtime to foster children. It was those kids I told about the Neverworld Wake. I told no one else, not even my mom and dad. Somehow I knew that those children, with their wide eyes and knowledge of the dark, their kingdoms of mourning and hide-and-seek, nap-time and snack, that they, of everyone, would understand. I told them I'd visited the secretest, wildest wrinkle in all the world. That one day they might find themselves in one too, some lost dreamland between life and death, where past, present, and future are a jungle, and hell can become heaven in the blink of an eye. "How do we go there?" a girl whispered. "If you're chosen, it'll find you. But the trick is not to be afraid, because it isn't so different from this world after all." Had the Neverworld been real? Or had it been a side effect of my injury, the right-sided subdural hematoma requiring a craniotomy for evacuation, 11 days passed in a coma, intubated and sedated. Sam had read me the book. One of my physicians looked like the keeper. Had it all been in my head? Had my senses, as I slept, pulled details from the boisterous world in motion around me, spinning it into a reality that existed only for me? Of course, the Neverworld had been real, though I could never prove it. I tried to. I tried to corroborate all the secrets. I discovered that while some things did check out, Mrs. Khan did live down the road from Wincroft with her collection of snow globes. There was an exclusive marina called Davy Jones's Locker, a Ted Daisy who lived in Cincinnati, an Officer Channing at the Warwick Police Station who worked in traffic. Others didn't. There was no mention of Estella Ornato on the internet. Honeylove Fried Chicken had once existed, but it had been replaced with a footlocker the year before. The White Rabbit, the Black-Footed Sioux Carpet, there was no way of verifying them. So many of the dots we had connected could not be connected here. The only real evidence of the Neverworld's existence was time. It no longer ran in a straight line for me. Instead, now and then, it looped and lost its balance. An hour would pass in the blink of an eye. I'd sit down for a history lecture and my mind would wander so completely, the bell would ring and I'd realize in shock that everyone was packing up to leave, an entire class's worth of notes scribbled across the dry erase board, which seconds earlier had been bare. I'd look around, wondering if the keeper was nearby, standing in a flower bed planting tulips or atop a ladder trimming ivy, because I recognized this out-of-body interruption for what it was. Aftershocks of the Neverworld. Instability, just as Martha had warned. My locomotive was skidding ever so slightly along the tracks. I still thought of Jim. But he was no longer the ghost who haunted me. I saw him as a boy, beautiful and unsteady like the rest of us. I saw our time together closer to what it probably was, something between the wild imagining of love and the real thing. Sometimes in that shaky in-between, we found each other, and it was real. Other times, it trembled and broke like a wild kite with too fragile a string. If Jim hadn't died, our love would have stopped and turned off the lights, like the carousel in a traveling carnival. The music played later, not as beautiful as I'd always thought. We would be barely remembered. In 20 years, we'd find each other on Facebook or whatever came after that, and we'd marvel at how ordinary we'd become, how all the glory we swore we'd seen in each other's eyes was gone. I thought of my friends every day. Sometimes when I closed my eyes, I could feel them beside me. I imagined where they were now. Because they were somewhere, and together. That I knew. I prayed that they were happy, or whatever lay beyond human happiness. I think they were. Mostly I thought of Martha, who she was and what she had done for me. There wasn't a moment of my life that I didn't owe to her. Sometimes it rendered me listless and sad, made me say no to the frat party, the Sunday night pizza feast, the spring fling. And I'd hole up alone in my dorm, drawing or writing lyrics, left with the painful truth of it. How the people who change us are the ones we never saw clearly at all, not until they were gone. I'd remember how Jim had insisted that one day I'd think with wonder, I was friends with Martha Ziegler. That's how big she's gonna be. He had been right. I shouldn't have lived. It should have been Martha. I was never the good one. I saw very little as it truly was. But that was what Martha taught me. We swear we see each other, but all we are ever able to make out is a tiny porthole view of an ocean. We think we remember the past as it was, but our memories are as fantastic and flimsy as dreams. It's so easy to hate the pretty one, worship the genius, love the rock star, trust the good girl. That's never their only story. We are all anthologies. We are each thousands of pages long, filled with fairy tales and poetry, mysteries and tragedy, forgotten stories in the back no one will ever read. The most we can do is hold out our hands and help each other across the unknown. For in our held hands we find pathways through the dark, across jungles and cities, bridges suspended over the deepest caverns of this world. Your friends will walk with you, holding on with all their might, even when they're no longer there. 2 years after the accident, I published a dream soundtrack. It was released by a little publishing house out of Minneapolis called Brace Yourself Books. Not even they knew what to do with it. The market for an album soundtrack for a movie that doesn't exist is a pretty small one. When I received the 4 printed albums from my publisher, though, I left school and boarded an Amtrak train bound for St. Louis. When I arrived, I took a bus to Wynnewood Falls, where I hiked a mile past pink brick mansions with shell fountains to a cemetery called Ardenwood. With a map, I took the self-guided walking tour past mausoleums of famous writers and captains of industry, peeling off when I found a section for the new graves. Whitley was up a stone path on a hill. Standing in front of her marble headstone made me cry, because the quote that Linda had chosen was from one of Jim's best songs, Immortal She. The fact that she'd had the insight to comb Whitley's Instagram and find it meant that maybe I'd been wrong about her, too. Maybe she'd understood her daughter all along. She lives on. Fireflies in my head. I will not forget her when I am dead. She is my memory. She is my song. She is the road when the car is long gone. She is the pillow on my bed. She is my words, unsaid. When the sun goes dark and the earth is bereft, she'll live in the echo the silence left. I set the little album by the flowers and walked away. Next, I boarded another Amtrak bound for New Orleans, and then a bus with broken air conditioning to Moss Bluff, a town with Spanish moss giving every street corner the shadowed scruff of a 3-day beard. I walked the 8 miles to Kipling's. To my surprise, the house was just as he'd described it, a rambling white mansion of peeling paint with a white peacock wandering the yard. I'd always thought he exaggerated his life, but in fact, he left out all sorts of colorful details, like the green Cadillac sitting in the middle of the driveway, weeds growing through the floor like hair overtaking old men's ears. I left the album on the porch swing. When I looked back, I saw a bent-over, gray-haired woman in a green house dress examining it. She looked after me, puzzled. Then Los Angeles. 2 days on the train, barreling past deserts and strip malls and palm trees. I took a bus to Montecito, where I walked to Cannon's house, a cream-colored Victorian. I slipped the album into the mailbox and jogged down the steps as a car alarm sounded. A man across the street stopped watering his lawn to look at me. 3 days later, I arrived in Providence, Rhode Island. I had read 7 mystery novels and 12 magazines and was out of clean underwear with a kink in my neck. I walked the final 4 miles feeling a strange sense of calm, arriving at Ziegler Auto Repair just after dusk. There was no one in reception. Most of the lights were off. I stuck the album in the window next to a sign, coffee 99 cents. As I was leaving, the door to the garage opened.
Can I help you?
I turned. It was Martha's dad. Though I had never met him, they had the same chin, the same thick glasses. He was wearing oil-streaked coveralls, wiping his hands on a rag. I introduced myself, telling him I was an old friend of Martha's.
Of course. Beatrice, right? That's so nice. It's not often I meet a friend of Martha's.
I'm here because I made an album, sort of. I wanted her to have it. It's a soundtrack for a movie that doesn't exist about 4 unlikely superheroes. They all have these hidden powers. Anyway, I wanted you to have a copy. I held out the album and he took it, turning it over. He put those thick glasses away and took out reading glasses, placing them on the end of his nose.
Ah.
He glanced up in surprise.
You dedicated it to Martha?
I nodded.
To Martha, who saw me and still believed. How about that?
He smiled at me, pointing toward reception. You know, I got her posters up in the waiting room. She always had a vision of the world that lay beyond, even when she was little. Nothing much scared Martha.
I let him show me her things, drawings she'd made as a child, a collection of paintings featuring an owl with purple feathers, blueprints of a winged invention she'd made. He showed me the work of Martha's older sister, too, a girl named Jenny, who had painted incredible canvases of oceans, hiding entire ink kingdoms and words inside the waves.
"Everything is on loan to us," he said, wiping tears from his eyes. "Even our children."
He offered me a root beer, but I refused, explaining that I had to go. "Maybe I'll come back sometime," I said.
"Well, sure. You're always welcome."
I left him staring after me, turning the album over in his hands, doubtlessly sensing there was much more I hadn't told him. Then I was on the bus, staring out the window at the darkened sky. At one point, I saw a streak of orange light along the horizon, but it was only the track lights on the ceiling of the bus. The shimmering leaves of the passing branches seemed somehow electric and alive, more than usual, and though I wanted to believe it was some hidden world opening up for me again, I sat back against the seat and told myself the truth. This time, it was just the wind.
This is Phoebe Stroll. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Neverworld Wake by Marisha Pessel. This program was directed by Maureen Monterubio. Executive producer, Diane McKiernan. Text copyright 2018 by Wonderline Productions, LLC. Production copyright 2018, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.